School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. In November, a new Museum of the Bible opened near the Mall in Washington, D.C. Funded and developed in large part by the family that owns the Hobby Lobby chain of craft superstores, the Bible Museum has already faced unwelcome publicity. That's because in July, Hobby Lobby reached an agreement with the Justice Department to pay $3 million and return more than 5,000 ancient clay tablets and other relics that have been smuggled out of Iraq. Now, the Hobby Lobby case has shone a spotlight on the trade in looted antiquities. The problem has been exacerbated by years of war and instability in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere in the Middle East. Stolen objects from war-torn Yemen and elsewhere are even turning up for sale on eBay, Amazon, and Facebook. One of the largest smugglers was the Islamic State, which looted the ancient Roman city of Palmyra in Syria. Now, as that militant group nears defeat, archaeologists and others are trying to put a halt to the trade in stolen statues, tablets, and mosaics that are often purchased by buyers in the U.S. and Europe. On this edition of Global Journalist, a look at the trade in looted antiquities. In a moment, we'll hear from some guests who have been following this issue closely. To kick things off, we're joined by Mark Altawiel in London. He's an archaeologist who has tracked this issue. He's a professor at University College London. Mark, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Well, tell us if you would, Mark, what sort of like the brief framework of international law sort of governing this trade?
Well, there are a number of guidelines. For instance, there's what's called the 1954 Hague Convention laws against looted items from conflict zones. However, countries often have to ratify these rules, and different countries have different levels of laws against the trade of antiquities. Some countries prohibit all forms of antiquities trade. Other countries allow private ownership of antiquities and have to then subsequently create more specific laws that address when and where can someone own antiquities, for instance.
Well, now, as I understand it, it's actually not that difficult to buy antiquities. And you actually did an experiment. You live in London and you decided just to go out and walk around and visit some antiquity shops and see if you could find some items that had been looted or taken from conflict regions.
That's right. Yeah, I just basically just went out to some places. London is one of the largest antiquities or really, I guess antiques and antiquities market in the world. So it's pretty easy to go to stores around here and find lots of ancient items.
And so when you went to these stores or shops, like how could you tell which items may have been looted? What did the people who ran the stores say about these things when you confronted them?
So I did two things. I went to antiquity stores and I targeted objects from specific periods, particularly early periods of something around 5,000, 4,000 years ago, when a time when a lot of art artifacts are fairly specific to certain regions. So I focused on those items. And then when I saw those items, which are likely to be from Syria and Iraq, I sort of asked people where they got these from, and in most cases they sort of avoided a direct answer, but in some cases they made it sound like they got it often not necessarily from Syria and Iraq, but at least neighboring countries, which suggested to me they were probably getting it from Syria and Iraq.
And so just to be clear then, there's actually a UN convention that bans the trade in antiquities from conflict areas, is there not?
Yes, there is, but not all countries have ratified that. In fact, just today, literally today, this is now illegal to trade antiquities from conflict zones in the UK. Only today it's become effectively law in the United Kingdom.
Well, tell me if you would, like, how does this trade operate? Is it normal that people sell antiquities without documentation about where they come from? I mean, you wouldn't buy like a condominium without sort of the paperwork and probably paying a title company to research who owned the condo in the past and any claims on it. Like, would you buy a $300,000 statue without that kind of paperwork?
That's precisely the problem. People do, in fact, buy very expensive items with essentially no documentation. For instance, I'll give you an example. We found a piece that's about, it was being sold for £50,000 in London. It was a lintel from Nawa, the city of Nawa of southwestern Syria. That piece was we documented to the point where we showed that it was like very likely looted because there was photographs of this particular piece in the 1980s, and under Syrian law, it would be looted. It's the only way you could have removed that piece. So in that case, the owner didn't even know, wasn't even aware that they had to even have any kind of information. And frankly, the law is sort of on their side in that they don't actually have to have that much or any documentation, although in many cases, they are certainly strongly advised too. So the fact that you can sell something a fairly high value with little to no documentation is it happens all the time.
I mean, why is this issue important? On some level, some people might say, like, what does it matter if there's an ancient stone tablet in Aleppo or in Iraq? What does it matter if it's there or if it's in a museum in New York or London?
Well, I think the bottom line is, and we've seen this with a number of cases now, including with what the State Department has shown from the raid they did a couple of years ago in Syria, for instance, where essentially this is funding both terrorism, but also various conflict groups or armed groups are being funded by these operations. So, you know, if we're trying to limit funding for groups that are creating nefarious activities around the world, as well as in the conflicts that are happening in the region, then, you know, we need to crack down on this kind of thing, I think.
Well, let's back up here, because as archaeologists, as people like yourselves, others involved in the art and antiquities market are trying to grapple with this problem. Like, how do you define what a looted antiquity is? I mean, there are many museums in Europe and North America with artifacts from the colonial period. I mean, I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, the British Museum has the Rosetta Stone in it, which was taken during the Napoleonic Wars in the 1800s, 1700s, and Egypt has been trying to get that back for years to sort of no avail.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big debate about what constitutes looted and not looted, and there are sort of disputes between countries that often cover that. Now, if we follow specifically laws when countries came into existence, for instance, Syria, Iraq, when they passed ratification rules that prohibited the sale of antiquities outside of their borders, or even the movement of antiquities outside of their borders, or even look at countries, for instance, like the UK or the United States or others, that have specific laws about antiquities, then if we enforce those laws, as well as international laws that are in the books, then we would certainly know that at least outside of cases like the Rosetta Stone, when they were taken, you know, hundreds of years ago, more recent kinds of items, we can certainly say those are likely to be illegal based on one or multiple sets of laws, whether it's the country laws or other international laws.
Well, talk to us if you would. Has there been any real change in the past couple years in the art market on this issue? Because it does seem like, you know, almost every month you see a news item about a major museum, a major collector having to return an item.
Unfortunately, I don't see much difference. I mean, if you go to the web or talk to art dealers, you often get very vague answers. Sometimes you do get documentation. Oftentimes it seems to be somewhat dubious in terms of origin. So it seems to me that this industry lacks clear guidelines for regulation, essentially, is what it is. And like you were saying, I think it's a very good point. If you're going to buy a vehicle, if you're going to buy a condominium, anything of high value, you usually have much more clear information that this item is legally obtained, comes from a specific origin, and you know exactly when it perhaps entered a country. Those kinds of pieces of information are missing from antiquities. We don't know when they enter countries. We don't know where they're from, although we can sort of tell sometimes based on how they look. And certainly we don't know the sort of timeline of those objects, how they went about from different traders, what was the transactions that involved them. So these very critical pieces of information are missing in this specific kinds of item or market, let's call it. And because of that, it's very easy to sell these antiquities in a kind of illegal way.
Mark Altawil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the trade in looted antiquities, a business that has been fueled by recent conflicts in the Middle East. To broaden our discussion now, we'll bring in three other guests who have been following this issue closely. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Amr Al-Azam. He's an associate professor of Middle East history and anthropology at Shawnee State University in Ohio. Also with us from Hamilton, New York is Michael Dante. He's an associate professor in the Classics Department at Colgate University and the academic director of the American Schools of Oriental Research Cultural Heritage Initiative. And on the line from England is Sam Hardy. He's a specialist in the trafficking of antiquities who teaches at the American University in Rome. He's also worked as a consultant on this issue for the International Council of Museums and UNESCO, the UN's cultural and educational agency. Welcome to all of you. Michael Dante, let me start with you. Let's talk about this example I mentioned in the introduction about Hobby Lobby and the folks who started this new Museum of the Bible in Washington. What do we know about where these antiquities came from that they were forced to return, and how did it get to them?
Antiquities most likely were looted somewhere in southern Iraq after 2003, probably from old Babylonian sites that were impacted by conflict-related looting or post-conflict looting. There's a clustering of time periods in the objects that were found. That my understanding of it is that these objects were brought to the United States under paperwork or manifest that indicated that they were ceramic tile. In a lot of cases, we're talking about old Babylonian plaques and cuneiform tablets. And this is frequently a way that illicit cultural property is smuggled. It simply falsify the paperwork and hope that the customs folk don't recognize what's actually being brought into the country. The material was seized, and then there was an attempt to look at the possible provenance of the objects. It didn't really require that much research to trace this material back to southern Iraq and that spike in looting that occurred.
Well, Amr al-Ams, let me turn this to you then. You are originally from Syria and have done a lot of work there. Obviously, the Islamic State controlled Palmyra, this huge, well-preserved Roman-era city, a number of other archaeological sites there as well. Talk to us about just generally what's happened in Syria since 2011 with respect to this issue.
Certainly. Look, the thing about, obviously everybody talks about ISIS now, but really the problem of looting began in 2012. In fact, the destruction of cultural heritage in Syria began in 2012 when the nature of the conflict in Syria shifted from one of a part of the Arab Spring, protesters going against the regime, to an armed confrontation between the regime on one side and an armed opposition on the other. And that's when cultural heritage became a casualty. And looting is primarily the biggest cause of damage. We think of the war, we think of the conflict and the fighting being a major, you know, cause of damage. But really the biggest cause to damage in Syria, for example, is the looting of cultural heritage sites. And this was being done by all sides, practically. So when ISIS shows up on the scene in the end of, in 2013 and moving into 2014, they come upon a pre-existing situation of looting. And what they then do is essentially intensify this process, they institutionalize it and they industrialize it. And that's what makes them, in a way, not just perhaps unique, but also so much more dangerous to cultural heritage because of this intensification and this industrialization of the process.
And Sam Hardy, I wanted to ask you as well, you've done a lot of research about how this business operates sort of from the ground level up. I mean, what do we know sort of, what's the first step in this process? Who is doing the looting from the archaeological sites or from the museums in places like Syria where these objects have been taken?
I think in lots of cases, some of the networks already exist. And then it just becomes amplified, whether it's because of the opportunity through the lack of control and policing, or the increase in need for some people who are trying to subsist when their economy has disappeared and their economic opportunities have disappeared, or they're trying to escape even in some cases, because we've seen tragic examples of refugees being driven to use cultural property to try to finance their escape and their survival abroad.
And Michael Dante, how is it then, so if these objects in some cases are taken just by local people that live near some of these archaeological sites or from museums, how is it that they sort of get laundered? Sam Hardy mentioned a case where some refugees moving into places like Lebanon or Turkey out of Syria sort of are forced to carry these, or these stolen antiquities are mixed in with them. But sort of like, what does the trade look like once the objects are taken from antiquity sites?
They're collected together by all the belligerents in the conflict and by criminal organizations that are operating independently. And then different types of antiquities usually follow different routes and smuggling methods. So coins versus sculptures versus mosaics, there are different markets, different smuggling techniques, and different laundering methods that are required. Some of the material will work its way towards the illicit markets in the West faster, such as coins, things that can be put into an envelope and mailed from somewhere like Lebanon or Turkey. The values on these objects are a little easier to determine, and they're easier to launder since they would show up in terms of provenance as somewhere from the Eastern Mediterranean, versus sculpture or mosaics, which are stylistically more indicative of a particular region or time period. That obviously those objects are larger, they're harder to smuggle, and it requires more time and energy. So there, some of the antiquities will move towards the market faster than others. Much of the material right now is still either in the conflict zone, or it's being hidden, or it's in countries like Lebanon and Turkey. The farthest I've seen some of the material that's been looted since 2011 has been in the southeastern part of Europe.
And Michael, if I could just follow up with you then, is there not some sort of database that helps people in the art market, that helps police, Interpol, track this? I mean, some of these items that are being looted were looted from museums, like museums in Mosul, museums in Aleppo, places like that.
Unfortunately, in a lot of cases with the museums in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere, museum records, including the United States, museum records are not that up to date and frequently. There are a lot of gaps there where there might be a good inventory. There's not a digital photographic record of the antiquities, and that complicates matters. This has especially been the case in Syria, for example, where you have museum collections that have been looted, but also the storehouses of archaeological excavations, and those objects have far less documentation. There's no central database right now for looted antiquities from the conflict zone. The American Schools of Oriental Research is putting together a database of looted material, and there are other independent efforts to put that together. There is such a database for fine art, which is a large part of the illicit art market. There is the Art Loss Register, which records things like oil paintings and more modern sculptures. But we lack a centralized database for looted antiquities at the current time.
And Amr al-Ams, talk to us about the infrastructure that the Islamic State set up to operate in this area. It sounds like they actually became sort of quite professional in looting antiquities. I mean, a lot of the publicity focused on blowing up certain statues or destroying certain statues in places like Palmyra, but it seems like there was also a sophisticated bureaucracy as well.
Certainly. I mean, you have to understand that for ISIS, cultural heritage is a very versatile resource, and you loot obviously what you can sell, but you can also use other elements that maybe are too big to sell or just unsellable for whatever reason for other things such as propaganda or to make certain public statements, political or otherwise, and that takes you into, for example, the blowing up of things. These are to make public statements. But as far as the looting is concerned, they institutionalized the process. They started by issuing licenses to local looters who could be either just local people who just want to make a little bit of money on the side, what we might call subsistence looting, and also as we saw this evolve in the end of 2014, ISIS themselves became actively involved in the digging. They would hire their own crews, they would bring in bulldozers, and they would sell the stuff either through intermediaries, and they also had their own auction, a major auction in Raqqa, which they systematically sold goods through there. And they would get a cut from the proceeds at every single stage. So they were involved, you know, as ISIS, they were involved in right from the beginning, from getting stuff out of the ground to its final sale and departure from Syria, usually through Turkey and also through Lebanon at times as well.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about efforts to halt the trade in looted antiquities. The Islamic State stole millions of dollars worth of cultural objects from museums and archaeological sites in Syria and Iraq, and recovering the items is no easy task. We're joined now by Amr al-Azam of Shawnee State University, Michael Dante of Colgate University, and Sam Hardy of the American University in Rome. If you're interested in more Global Journalists, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our videocast on YouTube. Sam Hardy, let me turn this back to you then. I wanted to ask you as well about what sort of steps might be taken to slow this trade or halt this trade now that as we mentioned, ISIS has been defeated. Is this sort of like a moment where some progress could be made?
Hopefully. I mean, it's obviously very encouraging that international organizations are taking it more seriously, that states are taking it more seriously, but they're still very focused on specific organizations or specific territories. So when this erupts in another place, as it inevitably will, they will have to start introducing these measures again. And the market as well may more or less enthusiastically try to do something about it, but there is the opportunity, the groundswell, the public opinion, to push for genuine change. I think possibly the most fundamental thing, assuming that we're not going to get the introduction of massive police forces and massive infrastructures to deal with it in terms of law enforcement, which I don't think is realistic to expect given countries haven't done that yet, is the change in the market, because ultimately it's the market that drives the looting. You know, the buyers are either willing or sometimes even actively enthusiastic in trying to acquire these objects. You know, there are examples where you see where people are actively trying to buy objects from conflict zones, or otherwise they don't care. So if we can get the buyers' attitudes to change and see buying dodgy art, suspect art, in the same way that they see buying ivory or other bloody commodities, then we might be able to see genuine progress.
Well, Michael Dante, you heard Sam Hardy talking about trying to change the art market. And right now, as he mentioned, there are people that are openly seeking to buy antiquities that were taken from conflict zones. I mean, are there some analogies in how sort of black market trade in certain items has been limited in the past? I think about how there was a change in the diamond market in the 1990s when a lot of blood diamonds were coming from civil war zones in West Africa. Is that a possible template for how to address this?
To a certain extent, it's not directly analogous. The blood diamond trade, mainly from Sierra Leone, or the ivory trade, has some similarity in terms of the law enforcement modality and what needs to be done. Certainly the public awareness that's campaigns that have been directed at the ivory trade and the diamond industry, the blood diamond trade, have been very helpful in disrupting the market for those commodities, and we need to have a similar sort of effort. Unfortunately, there's as Sam has said, there are people who are perfectly willing to buy antiquities from these conflict zones, knowing full well that it could be funding terrorism or the continuation of this horrible warfare in that region. The attention that's being directed to this issue hopefully will continue for some time, but I suspect that we'll see a reduction in the amount of attention dedicated to this, and that attention will move on to other issues. In terms of disrupting the markets, some of the best things that could probably happen is a higher degree of prosecution and conviction for the purchase of antiquities, and also stiffer penalties. Frequently, when people are caught with this material, they really receive a slap on the wrist, and that does not discourage the trade.
Well, why do you think that is, Amr Al-Ams? We're talking about this trade in black market goods when people are caught money laundering, when they're caught trafficking in drugs. Very often they face criminal prosecution. Here, I mean, you probably know the data better than I would. It doesn't seem like you hear of many cases where people are prosecuted and put in jail for trading in stolen artifacts and stolen antiquities.
Unfortunately, it's not seen as a high priority issue for most law enforcement agencies. I believe that, for example, the Art Crime Unit here in the United States, which is an arm of the FBI, has something like 16 agents to cover the entire country and all activity connected with art theft, almost including antiquities. That's just not feasible. The other thing, I think there's this also underlying, I don't know what to call it, but there's a sense that for some people, they think that buying looted antiquities or buying antiquities from conflict zones, we'll call them blood antiquities, if you will, somehow helps or saves these items, or that you're doing something good. And in fact, in 2015, there was quite a remarkable, I think, op-ed by the recently retired head of the Baltimore Art Museum here in the U.S., who basically tried to make the case saying it's all right to purchase this kind of, because we're somehow doing something good or we're saving it. So I think there's a number of different reasons why they still get off lightly. And I think until there's a change in the attitude
on some people might find that to be a reasonable argument and say, well, you know, we're taking these antiquities, we're taking these artifacts from places that are unstable fundamentally, and we're protecting them in a museum.
Yeah, but this is a very false argument because you're not really doing the place any good. All you're doing is encouraging more looting. Remember, this is a supply and demand process. And by taking items out of these areas, you're just increasing the demand. You're increasing, the demand that increases and therefore there's more supply. In addition to the fact that you're doing great harm and damage to the place. But I'm just saying that these underlying existing sort of attitudes that still seem to prevail do not help. But until this is criminalized, until people start to understand that when you do buy these looted antiquities, you are essentially also helping some terrorist or some criminal organization make money, and that could end up causing harm or possibly even leading to the death of U.S. Soldiers, if you're thinking of the presence of troops in Iraq or in Syria and other parts, conflict zones like that, then this trade will continue. We need much stronger restrictions against this kind of behavior.
And Sam Hardy, talk to us a bit about how technology is changing this trade. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal recently talking about the presence of looted antiquities on eBay, even on Amazon, on a number of common online shopping sites. What do we know about that? How, for you as a buyer, could you even know if what you're buying is real?
Well, I think it's not necessarily changing the market so much as simply expanding it. People will use the internet the same way they use other means of buying, in the same way they use the internet for buying other commodities. But certainly it's making it easier. Make it easier for people to make connections between extractors and consumers, and make it easier to shift objects without being observed. You know, even the stuff that's turning up on these public online platforms is relatively easy to monitor compared to the stuff that's being traded privately on WhatsApp or in Facebook messages rather than on Facebook pages. So we're seeing a real increase in private online trading, which simply can't be monitored. And this is again why the focus needs to be on the market, because it's not something that we can expect source countries to control. And it's not even something that is readily accessible for other law enforcement agencies to try to control. It's something that really has to be done through the ethics of the consumers, if they have any.
And just real quickly, Sam, if I could stay with you, we have just a few seconds left. Are you optimistic that things will change over the next couple of years?
No. I think this is something we've seen in conflict after conflict, the Lebanese Civil War, the Cambodian War, even with the genocide there. This thing's carried on for years and decades, and you see the same countries that have been conflicts, antiquities markets in previous conflicts being up now.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Mark Altaweed, Amar Al-Azam, Michael Dante, and Sam Hardy. Our assistant producers this week are Juwan Choi, Alexandra Churchill, and Samantha Lucas, with supervising producer Rachel Foster Gimbel. Alisa Blyle is visual editor, Aaron Hay is audio engineer, and Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.